to order. Good morning, Madam Mayor. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well.
Thank you all for being here. We are going to take up Senate File 1972. And yesterday I introduced this bill, having given a lot of consideration and heard a lot of testimony and recommendations from members of the Senate and from the general public. Today is our day to work this bill up. I'm here, and we are all here to hear what you have to say and how we can improve this bill. I know that there are amendments, and I welcome anyone's effort to try and improve this bill and make it the best it can be for the state of Minnesota. And I see all the amendments and the testimony offered with that purpose. And so I'm excited today to see what the end result will be. With that, we have many testifiers, and we're going to start with public testimony this morning. And I'd like to begin with Ms. Honey, Kathy Honey from Fagry Baker Daniels. Ms. Honey, welcome back to the committee.
First, good morning, Madam Chair.
I had your coffee.
First. Yes, I did have my coffee. My name is Kathy Honey. I'm a lawyer at Fagry Baker Daniels. And the provisions that I worked on were a couple of different tax increment financing provisions. I think in particular, Madam Chair, you wanted to hear how my client Maple Grove felt about the change in the soils efficiency district language that was specific to Maple Grove that is broadened in the bill in front of you in terms of a global provision. And so we are totally fine with the global language. We really appreciate Mr. Sylvia's, I said that right, efforts. Going from prosecuting people to writing tax increment language is quite an amazing feat, and he's done a really good job on it. He did keep us apprised of where he was at, and it does work for us. I have been in conversations with the Apple Valley representatives, Mr. Casserly, and as I understand it, there may be some discussion of amendments, and so naturally we would reserve any comments to look at the finished product as to whether that continues to work. But we're fine right now, and we really appreciate the effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Honey. Any questions or comments for Ms. Honey? I know you're going to be staying to join us later, too, and folks, there is an Apple Valley amendment that's going to be offered later, but that'll be the first one that we offer when we get to amendments. So I know you're here, and we will get to that, but we do want to hear some of the testimony first. And so before we take any testimony against what's in the bill, please know the amendment is coming. Mike Hickey from the National Federation of Independent Businesses.
How you doing?
Morning, Madam Chair and members. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. As many of you know, NFIB is the largest business group in terms of entities with about 12,000 members statewide and a significant member base in every district. And just wanted, Madam Chair, I want to say thanks to you for the strong support on some big issues in this bill that have been around for a long time. We've never really been able to resolve them from our perspective, and appreciate the continued support on the statewide phase out of the statewide commercial property tax and also on the upfront exemption on capital equipment. I caught Senator Ortman's estimate she threw out yesterday. And if you look at where, for those of us, those of you who have been around a while, such as myself, if you look at where we were on commercial property taxes 10, 15 years ago, and we've certainly made some progress with the 01 bill, but based on the estimates that Senator Ortman shared with the committee yesterday, if we went from 10th to 19th, on an urban piece of commercial property valued at $1 million, and 13th to 24th on a rural piece, that would be just tremendous progress, pretty much resolving the issue from a Minnesota perspective. We're never going to be last in taxes on anything or bottom of the list on anything, but that would really be significant progress, and we think that would be very encouraging to job generators and investors. And so we think that kind of progress would really matter, and we really appreciate the continued effort on the bill. Also appreciate the provision on capital equipment, the upfront exemption. I've had a lot of complaints over the years from members about why do I have to fill out this rebate? Why do I do it? What inevitably happens with rebates is people give up on them. They don't follow through all the way on them or even start them. And so the upfront exemption on capital equipment, it starts with small business and grows, as you know, under the bill. But that's very helpful to small entrepreneurs who prefer to do less paperwork, less administration, and just get the benefit at the point of purchase. And so just wanted to say thanks on these couple of key issues, and small business really appreciates it, and thanks for the time.
Thank you,
Chairman Designate.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Next up is Mark Haveman. Mr. Haveman, are you here? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Mark Haveman. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. I'd like to focus my comments today on the provision of the bill on expenditure class reporting for local governments. We appreciate the inclusion in the bill. This is something that we actively do at the MTA in consultation with organizations and others who are interested in understanding reasons for property tax increases. As important as program-based budget reporting is to give citizens an understanding of how tax dollars are being used, it doesn't tell a complete story. And understanding the cost drivers of local government and being able to quickly decipher what those cost drivers are and understand trends is important to understanding local government budgets. This is something, as I said, we do routinely in our organization. When we do these types of investigations and basically prepare the types of reports that are being asked of in this bill, it takes us about 6 to 8 hours. And that's doing it by hand with a manual calculator summing up existing budget information that local governments are typically providing. So with respect, it is, of course, a new mandate. At the same time, we believe it's a very humble mandate and a low-cost mandate and a low-effort mandate that is more than offset by the value provided to taxpayers in understanding local government budget trends and decision-making. Thank you very much.
Mr. Haveman, if I could ask you, did you see how we tied the truth in budgeting to the incentive for local governments to, with their LGA payment, there was a boost payment, 14 cents, up to $25,000 for cities. If they did, first of all, performance measures, that was 2010 language, and then we added in the truth in budgeting for that incentive. And I wonder if you had a chance to see that. Because for me, it may be a mandate, but it's not an unfunded mandate.
Madam Chair, thank you for raising that. Yes, I did see that. And certainly anything that helps this along, even providing some incentive, economic incentive, is a worthwhile thing to do.
Thank you, Mr. Haveman. Ms. Rocco, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Kay Rocco, and I am the Director of Public Policy for NIAP, the Commercial Real Estate Development Association. And I am here this morning to let you know that we really appreciate your acknowledgement of the importance of two provisions that we've been working on for some time, the phase-out of the state general property tax, as well as expenditure-type reporting requirement for cities and counties. And we also appreciate and acknowledge the hard work by each and every one of you on behalf of the citizens of the state of Minnesota. We know your job isn't easy, and we just want to let you know that we appreciate your hard work, and it does not go unnoticed. Thank you so much for your good service.
Thank you, Ms. Rocco. Mr. Keith Carlson and Ms. Patty Nauman, and we might as well have Jen O'Rourke come as well.
Mr. Carlson. Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I first want to express my appreciation for the inclusion of Article 5, the technical corrections relating to the debt and tax rate limitations and other references to market value. The corrections to the references there will help ease the transition resulting from the adoption of the homestead exclusion last session. I do, however, want to express concern about the provisions relating to the financial reporting Cities and counties stand ready to provide any information that we generate currently for purposes of enhancing transparency and accountability to our taxpayers and our citizens, but at a time and in a manner consistent with the reporting that we do right now. We have worked with the author and the proponents of this section throughout the session and have indicated, in addition to providing the programmatic detail that we now report both to the state auditor as well as publish in the newspapers, that we would provide detail on employee compensation to the extent that they desired. And Bo Berenson from the Association of Minnesota Counties will provide some further detail. I do want to make it clear, if it goes beyond that, we clearly believe it is an unfunded mandate. Although the bill provides that performance aid can be provided for compliance with this. This is an existing aid that is already being given to those cities and counties that have agreed to abide by performance measurement and reporting. So we do not view this as funding what we believe is, in fact, an unfunded mandate. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. Nauman, welcome.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to comment today. My name is Patricia Nauman, and I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. I want to comment on a few provisions. There are some provisions in the bill that we support and some others that we have concerns with. And I will start with the object code reporting that Mr. Carlson just spoke to. Cities do support the goals of transparency, and we think that, by and large, these are really covered through the myriad reporting requirements that cities are already required to report by and through. We do appreciate Senator Daley's willingness to work with us to try to get this provision down to something that is more streamlined and a little bit more consistent with current reporting requirements. I would agree with Mr. Carlson in saying that although the performance aid does provide some incentive, this is really an unfunded mandate, and we have heard from many of our cities that this would cost significant money at a time when they are looking to try to streamline and be more efficient with their service provisions. So we hope that you'll continue to work with us to get something that's a little bit more streamlined as this bill progresses. We do support and appreciate the clarifications on the provisions regarding the TIF for neighborhood recovery that better define the foreclosure definitions and provide for some other clarifying fixes there. We also support the provision on the requirements around structurally substandard buildings at 50%, so we appreciate that, as well as the market value homestead exclusion cleanup fixes that are in the bill. I did want to speak again to the LGA freeze that's in the bill that I spoke to yesterday or the day before here. Yesterday. Just to reiterate that although we don't have a policy on the LGA freeze, we do our policies do support having a functioning formula and one that is less volatile, so we would encourage you to keep working toward those fixes as you go along with LGA reform. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Ms. O'Rourke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. First, we want to comment, if we can, on just a few different pieces in this bill. First of all, the provision brought forward by Senator Daley is Senate File 1741. I first want you to know we've been working with the advocates for this provision since August and had a really good sit-down, I think, between a lot of finance directors, as well as the two individuals that spoke earlier and just talked about a lot of what's already provided by finance directors. And the one thing that I've really taken away from this whole discussion in the 4 or 5 months that we've been working on this is the real struggle that cities have in not providing too much information or overwhelming the public with the volumes and volumes of data that's available versus making it simple enough to understand and providing enough. Because we've heard from cities all over the map on this one, everything from, well, that's very close to what we already provide our citizens, to this would require us to buy a new software package and what have you. And as somebody with a statewide association and representing 800-some cities, there's quite a bit of difference in terms of cities' finance departments and the number of staff that they have on board that could take on this kind of activity. As Patty alerted to earlier, we do not have a problem with the transparency goals that this provision brings forward. As you know, there are a lot of publishing and reporting requirements already on cities in terms of their expenditures and financial reports. The one last piece on the NIA provision that I'd like to leave you with today addresses the penalty provision in that bill, and I believe it can be found in page 56 of your delete all amendment. The penalty right now in this bill for cities and counties who do not provide this information would withhold LGA, municipal street aid, and police and fire aids. I would just leave you with the fact that you could take two cities, a Detroit Lakes that's around population 8,000, and then a metro area, Lake Elmo or Amada Midi, who does not get LGA, and look at what those aid amounts from the state are in terms of their revenue base. And just, I don't know that it's necessarily fair if this is to move forward, that being a penalty. And my last comment on that would be just, I don't know who's enforcing this provision. Something we've talked about with the state auditor's office as well as the advocates for this entire provision. I don't know that it's very workable. So I guess I'd ask you to remain open to that as this moves forward to the floor and with conference committee. Moving on the LGA freeze, I believe Gary Carlson spoke to that earlier in the week, and our thoughts still stand on that. We certainly understand the reason for the freeze and remain committed to working with Senators Hoffman and Chamberlain and Senator Skoy on the LGA working group. We would like to be on record thanking you for certain provisions in this bill, and one big one would be the homestead market value exclusion fix that you included in one of the articles. This absolutely needs to be done this year, so thank you for that. And additionally, the measures that are related to redevelopment, particularly Senator Howe's bill on the 50% threshold and then the historic tax credit extension. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Rourke. Mr. Berenson, good morning.
Morning, Madam Chair, members. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I just wanted to follow up on some comments that you heard from Keith Carlson from the Intercounty Association. Our organization is concerned with that expenditure type reporting provision in this bill, simply because expenditure type reporting is not standard practice for municipalities right now, and would require significant expenditures in staff time, possible computer software reporting, reprogramming changes. So what I wanted to do is kind of show to you what we could provide along the lines prescribed in this bill based on what we're already providing to the state auditor. So if I could have someone pass out this handout.
Can I ask you all while you're there, I'm interested in what you have to say and concerned, especially about the penalties. I think that's a really good point. And I'm wondering, if we took out the penalties and moved the mandate back 1 year but kept the incentive for the transition, would you give some consideration to that as maybe a way to amend this, work with Ms. Rocco and Senator Daley? See, maybe if we just took out the penalty, we could incent these municipalities to do this kind of shift and then give them a little bit more time to make the adjustment without the severe penalties at the end. And maybe instead of carrot and stick, maybe hand in glove. I don't know. But hopefully you all will talk to Ms. Rocco and see if there's some way to make it less severe an approach here on the part of the state, and maybe we can all agree on that. Mr. Berenson.
Yeah, so if you look at the handout I've presented, if you think back to the bill, it basically requires summaries on three fronts: revenues, expenditures by program, and expenditures by type. The revenue and expenditures by program is the type of reporting we're already doing, cities and counties are already doing, both in budgetary format at the start of the year and in audited financial statements later in the year. When you get down to the expenditures by type, that's the new type of reporting that's not common practice among municipalities. However, as Mr. Carlson said earlier, we are annually providing employee compensation and benefit data to the state auditor. So if you combined the revenue and expenditures by program reporting we're already due with that employee compensation reporting we're already due, I believe you get to 90% of the reporting requirements in the bill without this added mandate and cost that will come along with the expenditure type reporting that's detailed in the bill. So I just wanted to give members an idea of how close we could get to that bill without incurring those substantial staff time and software reprogramming costs that we believe would be required under this bill.
Well, Mr. Berenson, I've done the prep work on these kinds of budgets, and I've also been a consumer of the information that is provided by the cities and the counties, and it seems to be cyclical. At some points, residents want to see, well, where's my budget going? It's going to public safety, it's going to human services, it's going to parks. And then cyclically, you know, a couple of years later, people want to see, well, how much am I spending on, you know, employees, and how much am I spending on, you know, costs or other supplies, and, you know, and so I think it's cyclical, and we need to have both. I think the residents are entitled to both, and I'd like to see us progress to that place where if they ask it either way, they get all the information and it's available to them because it's their money. And I think we have to remember that this is taxpayer money, and they want to see where it's going. So in the interests of transparency, in the interest of not turning this into, like I said, too severe an environment for these cities, I hope you will work with Ms. Rocco and with Senator Daley and see if there's some way we can provide information for the residents so they don't feel left out. They want to be able to look at it both ways. We also don't want to create huge burdens for our cities and counties. So I'd appreciate more work on that, and we're open to your amendments on it. All right. Thank you. Other questions or comments for this panel, members? Senator Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, I think it depends on which way the city reports. You know, the administration for public safety or for the police department, is that in administration or is that in public safety? And I think that's where you get into difficulties when you try and compare local governments where money is being spent. And I think we do need to work to see how we can get that standardized.
Other questions or comments? Thanks. I know you're going to be around for a little while, and we'll be watching for our amendments, and there will be some. So thank you. I am going to deviate a little bit from the agenda this morning because I know that I'd like to take testimony from David Minkinen from the Minnesota High Tech Association. We also have Commissioners Franz and Showalter. I'm not sure whether, gentlemen, you want to testify after we've offered amendments or whether you want to testify about the bill as is, but maybe you can advise our staff and let us know which you prefer, because it may be a few hours before we get a bill fully marked up for you to comment on. Mr. Minkinen, good morning again, and welcome to the Senate Tax Committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for allowing us to speak today, and good morning, members of the committee. My name's David Minkinen. I'm a partner at Deloitte, and I represent Minnesota High Tech Association. I'm a chair of their Government Affairs Committee. And our organization represents about 350 technology companies throughout the state. We have large companies like 3M, IBM, Microsoft, and we have smaller companies like Digital River. So we have a wide range of companies that we do represent. There's a couple provisions in there that our members are very supportive of: the angel investor tax credit, the upfront capital equipment exemption for sales tax. But what I want to speak with you today is an amendment that I believe will be offered, which is a data center amendment. And I'd like to first thank the chair of the committee and members for the work that you guys did last year in offering up an exemption for the data center for sales tax. We made important strides last year in improving Minnesota's competitiveness, attracting new data centers, and encouraging existing data centers to upgrade the facilities here in Minnesota. But while we appreciate those provisions in last year's bill, we recommend that the investment time frame for be lengthened, the investment minimum should be lowered. Data centers are very, very costly things to build, and they're typically built over a long time frame. And they cost about $450 to about $1,250 per square foot. And due to the high cost, it makes it very, very challenging for them to make that $50 million investment over 2 years. It's a very challenging threshold to meet for those organizations. And Minnesota is a very ideal location for data centers due to the climate that we do have, the world-class workforce that we do have, and the infrastructure. But according to an IT location study, Minnesota ranked 48th, well behind Des Moines and Iowa in location of IT data centers. Also, Minnesota stands to gain well-paying high-tech jobs with this change in law. DEED estimates that about a $1 billion capital investment data center results in about 2,000 to 3,000 jobs, making $50,000 per year. In addition, Minnesota will get a really high return on investment due typically a dollar in investment in taxes does return the state an additional dollar. I want to give you an example of a potential data center here that's going to be locating in Minnesota. I can't reveal the name due to competitive nature of it, but there is a data center looking to invest about $10 million per year over 5 years to build out about 100-square-foot data center. It will require them to hire about 30 to 52 network software engineers. This organization has actually delayed the decision for about 3 years due to the lack of incentives that has pushed out those decisions to invest in other locations. We share a similar goal to keep Minnesota a center to grow innovation, grow high-skilled, high-wage jobs, and modifying this capital equipment tax for data centers will accomplish that. So we appreciate the work that you did last year. We encourage you to take a look at this data center amendment. You know, try to lower that investment minimum and also the time frame to allow more data centers to be able to locate here in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Mankin. And why did I think you were going to say something about the Viking Stadium?
Well, the Viking Stadium, the Viking Stadium is a very important issue, too. You know, they're both jobs issues. You know,
no, I really asked for it, didn't I?
It's a data center, whether it's a Viking Stadium. So the economy is the number one issue, so they're both jobs issues. So,
thank you. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Minkinen about the data center amendment? Thank you for testifying. I know you had to leave this morning. Thank you for being here this morning. We also have the commissioners Showalter and Franz, and you're very welcome to testify about the bill or the amendments, commissioners, so you can get on to other very important business that you have, I'm sure. Good Commissioner morning. Franz, welcome back, and Commissioner Showalter to you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We appreciate your flexibility allowing us to interrupt your schedule briefly here. And I know you've always said that I'm welcome at the Tax Committee, and so I brought along a friend today, Commissioner Showalter.
I bring friends every day, too.
It's always good to travel with friends.
It is.
But anyway, thank you. We know you're doing a lot of work, and we want to get out of your way so you can finish your work on this bill. And obviously, when the bill is completed, we'll be able to provide more responses and more technical issues that you come up. What we wanted to do today, though, was just to briefly outline some of the governor's concerns, because I know we've had conversations about trying to move forward on legislation together. But we wanted to make sure today that from my point of view, I'll let Commissioner Showalter talk about another issue. But from the governor's point of view, the concern about the jobs credit aspect here, and the governor is really concerned that we have a jobs program or a jobs credit that requires the creation of a job, and he's concerned that this statewide business property tax relief, although is a nice tax relief if available, is not going to require any jobs. And the problem is it's funded through the reserve account and the budget reserve account, and also creates a deficit in the next biennium. So the governor is very concerned about working on any kind of a tax relief program that doesn't really target jobs, the creation of jobs, that's using funding from the budget reserve to fund it, and also creates a deficit in the future years. So those are just wanted to make sure that as we work forward together on any legislation that you have those concerns of the governor.
Thank you, Commissioner. And on that, I would say when I spoke with you the last time, I encouraged you to mention to the governor our approach to the capital equipment upfront exemption. I think that's very clearly directed at capital investment that will encourage economic activity with the purchase and also economic activity with new production. And I think that is a jobs tax credit. I think it's far preferable to the jobs now provision proposed by the governor, because there's certainty with that. With the tax credit, it's hard to know that folks will actually generate new jobs with the addition of a very short-term tax credit that's limited in scope. And I'm not sure that it's going to incent anybody to hire somebody. If they need them already, we shouldn't be creating the tax credit. And so we've been through that, but I hope that you will mention to the governor the capital upfront exemption and some of the other provisions in our bill, like the angel tax credit and some of the other tax credits that we're working on, hopefully the data center tax credit. I think those are good job creation proposals and good alternatives to what the governor has proposed.
Madam Chair, thank you. We will obviously go through the bill in detail and look at all those provisions, and I understand your issues there. We just wanted to make sure we were clear about our concerns about the overall aspect of the bill.
Well, and Commissioner, let me state publicly that I'm hoping that this bill will pass the Senate and will match up with a House bill that has some substantial differences in it, and that you will join us in those conversations when we get there, that you and the governor will take an active part in negotiating some good work on behalf of the state of Minnesota that will generate that economic activity. I think it's up to the governor to join us at the table through you or on his own end with you. You can bring that friend, too.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, the governor is a want to show up sometimes, but
he's welcome this morning, Governor. If you're listening, come join us.
But we will be prepared to engage fully as this bill moves forward. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Management and Budget. I have also appreciate the flexibility of the chair to hear our testimony and would like to just briefly represent some serious concerns with the overall financial structure of this bill. As you know, we have gotten through a significant recession. We have drawn down our reserves. We have had shifts. We have weakened the financial situation of the state markedly in recent years. The last two forecasts have been positive, and they've helped us restore some of our reserves, and this bill takes us going the other way. It uses $100 million to help finance short-term needs, as well as adds to the structural gap in the 14 and 15 biennium. This is taking us the wrong direction, and so I would like to make sure that we underscore our opposition and concerns with using the budget reserves for any current resource needs. That any changes to the budget should be paid as we go, so that we find resources to use balance those, and that we use the financial discipline which the state has used for decades. That includes using fiscal notes for clearly articulating changes to spending needs, for replenishing the reserves and making sure that we keep them at the statutory level whenever possible. And ultimately trying to balance our budget not only in the current biennium but in the longer term. And I think in all of those areas we have some work that we still need to do with the committee. So I appreciate the opportunity to make these comments, Madam Chair.
Commissioner, I appreciate your comments, but I do have a response, which is these are not short-term needs. Stimulating economic recovery is not a short-term problem. It is a long-term problem for the state of Minnesota, and what we've proposed is long-term sustainable solutions and encouragement and growth. The repeal of the state general levy would occur over many years. It will create a structural deficit, but it also will encourage growth in the economy by allowing these businesses across the state of Minnesota to reinvest those dollars, which is what we need to occur here. You said pay as you go. Commissioner, I'm so glad you said that, because this bill encourages you and your counterparts in the administration to help us identify the reductions we need to pay as you go. And so you have a seat at the table, Commissioner. You're here this morning. I'm so glad you are. And when Commissioner Franz comes back to work with us, I hope you'll be there too. Because I think that there's no one better in the whole state of Minnesota to help us find the reductions we need to prioritize this bill than you. There's nobody better. And so I encourage you to look at this bill, go back to your budgets, which are $35.2 billion for this biennium, and help us find about 0.25% to help stimulate economic growth on behalf of the residents of the state of Minnesota. That's what we're talking about. I think that is fiscal discipline to reprioritize some of that money if we can. I think that it is fiscal discipline to pay as you go, and we are such partners in that. And that's why this bill was drafted exactly as it was, to say reduce state government budgets first. If you can't, then draw down the reserves. I would also say this about the reserves, Commissioner. You know that last year we ended up zeroing out the reserves, and we cut quite deeply into our cash flow account. This year, because of the fiscal discipline that we all engaged in, we have not only a full cash flow account, but we have full reserves, and we're paying back a significant portion of the school shift.
And so I think we have been fiscally disciplined. And to say maybe taking out up to $99 million, not all of it, hopefully none of it, that's up to you and the governor, but to take part of that to stimulate economic growth and put money back in married Minnesotans' tax pockets. I mean, 565,000 taxpayers are going to get a benefit with this marriage penalty conformity, plus all of this stimulation in the business economy. That's good for the state of Minnesota, and I would think the governor and you, commissioner, and you, commissioner, and every other commissioner and every other state employee would have an interest in helping us do that. So this is your open invitation. I don't have any gold engraved ones, but this is your invitation in this bill to come to the table and help us find some solutions that will generate economic activity.
Madam Chair, I appreciate comments back, and I just want to underscore that we have been trying to help the legislature throughout this legislative session find ideas, both ideas that are generated by the legislature and implement them within the executive branch. To wit, we've already processed more than 600 fiscal notes. Ideas that the legislature has come up with, a record number in an off session, to come up with ways to change the budget one way or another. Yet that is not what is being contemplated here. It is a new exercise to find new savings yet unidentified. We plowed this ground extensively last session. We discussed the impact of unspecified savings, of administrative authority to change things. We came to a reconciliation of that there might be some savings that we still have not realized. We are trying to. But to suggest that there is another $99 million that's there without any understanding of what you're talking about or where we're supposed to be doing that, I think is why you have a backstop, why there's a backstop of using the budget reserve for ensuring that that money shows up.
And, Commissioner, frankly, you haven't done enough. It's a $35.2 billion budget. To find a quarter of 1% is not asking too much on behalf of the residents of the state of Minnesota. And we have given you some ideas. We've also had some real challenges with your department with fiscal notes, and I would encourage you to read the legislative auditor's report on that. We've had a real challenge with that, but nonetheless, we've given you some solutions, and they are referenced in this bill. So I encourage you to go back to the table, roll up your sleeves, get out your pencils, you and the other commissioners and the other managers, there are many of them, and find some savings. Because I think it's there. I think every Minnesotan knows it's there and that we can do more to reduce the size of government to encourage the prosperity of individuals and businesses in the state of Minnesota. Are there others who have questions or comments for the commissioner? Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioners, I have great confidence in your abilities. That's why you're doing what you're doing in the positions you're in, and I know you're burdened and you have a lot to do over there. And sometimes I sit here and I think about, well, how do they manage these changes and the fluctuations and get all these fiscal notes out? So I appreciate it, and I know everybody here does, and I also have great confidence in your abilities and your experience and what you've accomplished. So we're not trying to beat up on anybody, but I think you could find about $100 million out there and out of $17 billion. But I do have great confidence in your ability to do that. Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Madam Chair, I thought it was the legislature that appropriated and the legislature that sent the money to the governor and the administration, and they administered what we appropriated. I think it's a little, well, I don't know exactly what the word is, but to ask them to come up with savings that the legislature is unable to achieve on its own, I don't know if that's a fair request to ask. I mean, why, if there's $100 million, you've got your spending committees in the majority. Why don't you ask them to come up with $100 million of savings?
Senator Skoy, I think it is abundantly fair for us to ask our own employees to help us find savings in our budget. Senator Skoy.
And Madam Chair, as Commissioner Showalter just said, they have been working with you. They prepared 650 fiscal notes trying to analyze the ideas and come up with ways to accomplish the goals. But It's the legislature's responsibility to appropriate.
Well, and Senator Skoy, they also have their own independent ability to identify some sources of funds and some excess spending, even some savings through attrition where they don't need to fill positions if folks retire. I mean, there are savings available here. They can deny it if they want. I haven't heard them deny it. But, you know, we shouldn't have to go through this process to identify such a small amount of savings, and we're trying to encourage them to be good partners with us. We don't want to do it over their objection. We want to do it with their participation and their cooperation. And I think that we can find some good solutions if we work together, and that's what this bill is. As I said, it's an open invitation to the commissioners, all of the employees, and the governor to help us find this, to prioritize relief and jobs stimulation for the state.
Just one final comment, Madam Chair. You know, earlier this session in the Tax Committee, we took a look at all the expenditures that occur in the Tax Committee, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars there. I know the House has taken a run at that. We've looked at that a number of years. Perhaps this committee should go back and revisit the expenditure report that we do, and maybe you can help the commissioners find the $100 million.
Senator Skoy, I would have loved to have heard your bill on that. Any other questions or comments? Senator Bach.
Senator Ortman, as long as this is being considered a jobs bill, just wondering what the motion is going to be when we move it out of here. Is the motion going to be to recommend to pass and re-refer to the Jobs Committee, or is that something we might need to consider doing on the floor under Rule 21?
Senator Bach.
It's either a tax bill or it's a jobs bill, Madam Chair.
Well, Senator Bach, the title is irrelevant. It accomplishes both purposes, and you can bring the motion, but there's no reason for this bill to go back to the Jobs Committee. In fact, many of these provisions were heard in the Jobs Committee, as Senator Michelle would attest to. So because they came from the Jobs Committee already and were included here, I think it makes sense to include the word jobs in our bill. Senator Bach?
Further, Madam Chair, it just says omnibus jobs bill, and I'm just wondering on the Senate Council sheet. I'm just wondering if the Jobs Committee has seen and passed the bill. That's all. That's what it is. I would think that they would have passed this to the Tax Committee if it says Omnibus Jobs Bill on it.
Any other questions or comments for the commissioners? Senator Howe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just was wondering if Commissioner Franz would maybe just comment. I know he's been doing outreach and been out talking to community leaders and business leaders and the general public. Just wondering if you got any comments on the sense of where the general public is on our tax situation and how our tax structure is.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Franz,
Senator, I can go for hours on this if you'd like, but I can give a short update if that's acceptable, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. It's been a great privilege actually to go out and talk to citizens and business groups around the state, and I'm always amazed and impressed by the intelligence and the questions that I get about their concerns. But a lot of the concerns about complexity, about fairness, and trying to make the system more understandable for the average citizen. So that is one of the really big themes that I'm getting. And the other theme is from a lot of business groups really want to see us try to improve reduce the complexity of the corporate tax as well and make it more simple and eliminate some of the deductions. So we're hearing a lot of good responses from people. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, commissioners. We'll see you back, I'm sure, soon, and hopefully in conference committee if this bill gets there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have John Thorson from AFSCME, Tom Bryant from the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association, and Molly Moylanen from Clearway, Minnesota. I hope you'll all join us at the table, and we'd love to hear what you have to say this morning. Mr. Thorson, welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Thorson with AFSCME Council 5. I feel like this is a return to the undercard of the testimony today, but I appreciate the opportunity to speak about my thoughts and concerns related to Senate File 1972. First, I'd like to acknowledge and applaud what we see as a good policy decision to conform with the federal tax provisions regarding married joint filers for 2012. We think it's a provision that puts money, keeps money in the pockets of consumers, creating aggregate demand that will move our economy forward. We also think it's been a good decision not to further reduce the renter's credit in this bill as well. Our concern related to those good provisions is how they're paid for, and echo the concerns of Commissioners Showalter and Franz that drawing down the reserves for a budget that's already not structurally balanced going into the next biennium, and further concerns that a provision of reducing and then phasing out the commercial, industrial, and seasonal rec property tax is a policy matter that's not paid for in this biennium, in the next biennium, and the bienniums going forward. That provision alone would add $180 million to the structural deficit of the next biennium, and through the year 2026 is a loss of almost $7 billion of revenue that's not being replaced by any other policy decisions in this bill. And the $180 million just for the next biennium is a 16% increase of the structural deficit. We think the stated purpose of these initiatives, we agree with. Jobs need to be created in this state. Right now, according to the Deeds' latest job survey, there's 161,000 unemployed workers competing for 50,000 unfilled jobs. For full-time jobs, those openings are, there's six workers competing for every one job opening. So the need is there. With local governments in the last year, there's 9,000 fewer local government employees than there were at this time last year, 16,000 fewer than there were in 2002, again, according to Deed. These are jobs that local businesses, when those dollars get spent in our communities, they don't discriminate against where those dollars come from. We think that the structural problems created with this bill further exacerbate that problem and ultimately don't lead to a good job climate in this state. Finally, I'd like to echo the concerns stated by the cities and counties related to the reporting requirements, and wish to work with them and the committee going forward to find a better solution for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thorson. Is Mr. Tom Bryant here? Mr. Bryant, please proceed. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Tom Bryant. I'm the executive director and legal counsel for the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association. That's a trade association of cigarette and tobacco wholesalers in the state of Minnesota. And I'm here to talk about our opposition to a provision in the omnibus bill that would tax little cigars the same as cigarettes. And I testified last year on a very similar bill, so excuse me for being somewhat brief, but just trying to refresh your memories. Cigarette wholesalers use a very high-speed cigarette stamping machine to stamp cigarettes. This is a carton of cigarettes. As the carton runs through the machine, it opens the flaps. Heat applies 10 stamps to each of the 10 packs in the carton all at once, closes a flap, applies glue, closes the other flap. Takes about 1.2 seconds to stamp a carton of cigarettes. A machine will stamp up to 30,000 packs in an hour. That's important because the provision in the bill that would require small cigars, or little cigars as they're known, to be taxed as cigarettes would require that our cigarette tax stamp be applied to those little cigar packages. There are about 200 different brands of little cigars on the marketplace. About half of those, 100, are the same size as a pack of cigarettes. They come in a carton. We can stamp those. The problem comes in the other 100 or so products. They're in different size packages, very thin packages like this, even metal tins like this. Our machines can't stamp these. Machines can adjust for height of package. So if they're a little taller or a little shorter, we can still stamp them through the high-speed machine. If they're like this, thinner or metal, we can't stamp them. What that means then is we have to apply these stamps, and this is a sheet of cigarette tax stamps, with what is called a hand stamp. This is a plug-in electric little iron that an individual uses when we can't machine stamp. And you have to put the tax stamp on the package and do one at a time. A person that's proficient in doing this at a wholesale operation can stamp about maybe 350 packages at once. I've talked to my wholesalers, and there's only 5 states in the country that require little cigars to be tax stamped like is being proposed. They've indicated they won't stamp the little cigar packages. It's too time-consuming, too burdensome, and too labor-intensive. It's just too expensive. In Iowa, some of the wholesalers are also members of our Minnesota group. They've stopped selling those 100 brands of little cigars because they won't hand stamp them. That brings me to another question about the bill and the revenue analysis. In the revenue analysis, it shows that the state will receive some additional funds if you change the tax on little cigars. I don't know if the revenue department took into account in their analysis whether 100 brands won't be sold anymore. The public can still get those over the Internet. You can buy the same brands of little cigars just like this over the Internet, pay no state excise tax, no state sales tax, and the mailman will deliver it to your mailbox. Can't do that with cigarettes anymore. The federal government prohibited that, but they can still do it with cigars. So I don't know if the revenue analysis is accurate because I don't know if they included that information. Finally, the bill requires that the Commissioner of Revenue issue a report on how efficient our cigarette and tobacco tax collection system is in Minnesota. We have a very closed system of cigarette and tobacco tax collection and payment here in Minnesota. There's a very small number of wholesalers that stamp cigarettes and sell tobacco products, about 35 or so, give or take one or two, that do that. They, on this one cigarette tax stamp, pay 4 taxes and fees. They pay the cigarette excise tax of 48 cents a pack, the cigarette health impact fee of 75 cents per pack, the state sales tax of 37 cents per pack. We collect that, the retailers don't, under state law. And then also what is called the 35 cent per pack non-settlement fee. For those cigarette companies that didn't settle the lawsuit with the state in 1998, they pay an extra 35 cents. So we have one group of small companies, about 35, collecting about $19 per carton and remitting that to the state. Those are the same wholesalers that collect the tax on cigars, pipe tobacco, et cetera. So it's a very closed, efficient system. I don't know how it can get much better than that. So I just want to bring that to the committee's attention because there is an appropriation of about $100,000 to do that report, and we think the system works very well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bryant. Molly Moylanen?
Moylanen, yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you,
Would
Mr. Chair and members.
Identify yourself for the record.
Yes. My name is Molly Moylanen, and I'm with Clearway, Minnesota. Our vision is to eliminate the harm that tobacco causes the people of Minnesota. Today, I represent a coalition of organizations, including the American Cancer Society, the Heart Association, the Lung Association, the Association for Non-Smokers of Minnesota, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, the Local Public Health Association, the Mayo Clinic, and the Minnesota Medical Association, among others. We were thrilled to see Senator Rosen's little cigar bill in the bill yesterday, and I want to reiterate our support for this smart policy change. I also want to note that today is our coalition's day at the Capitol, so many of you will be meeting with constituents on this specific provision and other important tobacco control issues later today. I testified in support of Senator Rosen's bill last session, so I will keep my remarks brief as well. Little cigars are cigarettes. They are the same size as cigarettes. Their physical appearance and construction are the same as cigarettes. They are most often sold in packs of 20 like cigarettes. They are usually filtered just like cigarettes. They are smoked the same as cigarettes. Smokers inhale them as deeply into their lungs as cigarettes. They contain as much nicotine. They're just as addictive and just as dangerous as cigarettes. One of the most notable similarities is that they are marketed to and experienced by the consumer just like cigarettes. Really, the only difference is that there is a little bit of reconstituted tobacco in the paper, and that makes it brown. Because of this small difference, They are taxed not as cigarettes. A traditional pack of cigarettes will cost $5 to $6 a pack here in Minnesota, whereas this pack of peach-flavored Remingtons costs $2. This one costs $2.15. Our tax laws regulating tobacco were crafted in the 20th century, and the case of so-called little cigars is a perfect example of where the laws haven't kept up with the times. By correctly classifying these so-called little cigars as what they really are, cigarettes, you will close this problematic loophole and uphold the integrity of our tax system. This provision helps protect Minnesotans, especially kids, from under-regulated tobacco products tax conformity. It's important to note that little cigars evade the federal ban on flavored cigarettes. Little cigars often come in candy and fruit flavors. In Minnesota, we have seen them in chocolate and peach and strawberry, grape, and even alcohol flavors in a transparent effort to appeal to young people. The combination of low price, availability, and flavoring makes so-called little cigars a huge concern for youth smoking. Data show that little cigar use is a growing problem for youth and young adults across the country and here in Minnesota. In December, the Minnesota Department of Health issued a new study entitled Teens and Tobacco in Minnesota. The findings were concerning. After decades of sharp declines in tobacco use among teens, progress is slowing. The report found that more than one-fourth of Minnesota high school students report that they have tried flavored cigars or little cigarettes at some point in their lives. Now, in terms of the stamping issue, we heard that they are unable to stamp them because of different sizes. Well, the truth is that the vast majority of little cigars do fit in the machines just like cigarettes. When a package of cigarettes comes in a non-traditional size, and some do, I have many examples here today, they either make them fit through the machine or they hand stamp them, and that is the cost of doing business. And that would apply to little cigars, but again, the majority are just the same size as regular cigarettes. Again, I want to reiterate our strong support for this provision. We applaud your efforts for closing this problematic loophole by updating the definition to reflect the evolving tobacco market. This is the right move, and it will help make the next generation tobacco-free. I also wanted to just share an article from the Washington Post that was published earlier this year entitled Teens Swapping Cigarettes for Flavored Mini Cigars. I think that would be helpful and just provide some background information.
Thank you, Ms. Moylan.
Thank you, Ms. Moylan. Jill Larson, and we'll have someone pass it out. Are you finished with your testimony?
I am. Thank you.
Could we have someone pass out the handouts? Jill Larson, followed by Tom Hesse. Ms. Larson, welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Jill Larson. I'm with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I will be very brief because I have spoken to most of these issues when these bills were in committee previously. I want to thank the chair for bringing this bill forward. We do support the provisions in the bill that would reduce the state property tax, phase it out eventually. This provision will help reduce the cost of doing business in Minnesota and will, in turn, make Minnesota more competitive. Also support moving to phasing out completely the capital equipment refund program and changing it to an upfront exemption. I think the way that it's been presented in this bill in terms of starting with very small businesses and over the years moving to have it be an upfront exemption for all businesses makes some sense. It is an administrative burden for all businesses, obviously more so for smaller businesses. And I think what hasn't been talked about much is that it's also a pretty large administrative cost for the Department of Revenue, so this will save some administrative costs down the road. Also support the increase in the funding for the angel investor tax credit. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Mr. Tom Hesse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I will echo all of Ms. Larson's comments and add one other item to the list. We certainly support the elimination of the monthly accelerated sales tax collection. That is an additional burden on retailers across the state, and happy to see that was also in the bill. But again, we support the phase-out of the statewide property tax, the increase in the angel investment credit, and, of course, the phase-out of the capital equipment refund program. Thank you very much.
Questions or comments from members for either of these testifiers or any of the others? Members, I would like to offer the A21 amendment, which is an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape I think best to proceed. And while they're passing that out, I'll tell you about the adjustments that have been made. There are three significant changes that I would ask us to make before we undertake further consideration of the bill. The first one is, unfortunately, to take out the excise taxes on the mini cigars and cigarettes. The other one is to take out the paint and supplies change from the wholesale to the retail sale level, and also makes adjustments to the bottom line on the spreadsheet, and Ms. McQuay can talk to us about that. It also would include the changes for the data centers that we heard about earlier this morning. So the changes would be made to the angel tax credit, which would be reduced to a $2 million addition to the angel tax credit, and the remaining adjustments would be made to the reduction in the state general levy. Because there is an elimination there, the elimination, the reduction for this year would not be quite as much in order to balance the bill. And members, that is the A21 amendment. We'll have Ms. McQuay review the spreadsheet. Hopefully all will adopt the A21 as a courtesy to the author. If all have seen it, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. A21 is adopted, and I appreciate the courtesy of the members here. Ms. McQuay, if you could review the changes to our spreadsheet as a result of the A21 amendment.
Madam Chair and members, the first change would be on line 16, line 7.5. I apologize, I don't think I have a line number in there, but that is to the angel tax credit, and that would change to a $2 million reduction to the general fund. The second change would be to the state general levy, and that would be a $3 million change. So, and then the on lines 24 through 30, those are the revenue raisers in the bill, both the motor vehicle paint and supplies, and the Senator Rosenbaum on the little cigars. Those revenue raisers would be removed. Those provisions net out to revenue raisers of 5.1, revenue reductions of 5 million. Yeah, they're leaving 100,000 on the bottom line. Revenue was kind enough to find an error in my spreadsheet to the good, so the bottom line number, you go to line 75, that bottom line number is 134.
Ms. McQuay, where does the data center line go in?
Madam Chair and members, the the data center changes are in the tails, and I am not. Recalling where I put this in the spreadsheet.
Ms. McQuay, do you want to look at it again? I know we caught you unaware this morning, and so if you'd like to look at it again and come back when you're ready, that
Thank
would
you.
Be appropriate.
Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Maybe, I assume this is on a computer. Maybe she could just print us out a new spreadsheet.
Well, and that would be fine if she has the ability to do that, Ms. McQuay, if, whenever you're ready to come back to us with this.
Madam Chair, thanks. I can do the revised spreadsheet if the committee thinks
that would
be
very
useful.
Helpful for everyone. Thank you. Questions or comments from members about the bill as amended? We're going to take some more testimony, and then there are other amendments. I know that the Apple Valley folks are ready with their amendment, and so maybe they'd like to go next. I know the mayor is here.
I'm sure.
Is it Mr. Casserly?
Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
This was an author's amendment, and it was a courtesy. I just need to express for the record regret that we're taking out the change to the how we construe these cigarettes that are parading as little cigars. I think the testimony that Ms. Moylan provided was pretty compelling, and I'm not sure why we took that out. Can you tell us why we took that out?
Yes. Senator Dibble, I would say that tax compliance is in the eye of the beholder.
So you don't believe that this was so you're saying that you didn't believe that this amounted to tax compliance or good social policy on tobacco use?
As I said, I think that it's very subjective how you look at that.
Madam Chair, we know that tax policy is used for a lot of different purposes. You have given pretty strong speeches yourself this morning about the purposes and goals and intents of this bill. And we know that from the testimony that Ms. Moylan provided and the article that she handed out, that manufacturers are parading cigarettes as cigars and are able to sell them for $2 a pack and allowing young people, luring young people into buying them with these sweet flavors and these low costs. And so I just need to express for the record some regret that apparently it appears that the tobacco industry has managed to have their way again and continue this practice in luring young people into smoking, which is regrettable because we know that the effect of young people starting smoking ends up costing hundreds of millions of dollars to the state every year.
Senator Hoffman and then Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Senator Dibble's point, I actually support the amendment. I do believe that it is in the eye of the beholder. But I also want to make a statement, since this is at the Health Committee, we're stepping out of our jurisdiction. But I do want to say if they're marketing to the youth and the youth are buying the cigarettes, last time I looked, that was illegal. And so if we're selling, if retailers or wholesalers or whomever is selling to the youth, that's an illegal act. And maybe that's what we need to address and not upstream from there. We know that the youth have been smoking for generations, that nothing's going to change that. Nothing we do in the tax policy is going to change that. So if our problem is that the youth are smoking, then we need to maybe make tougher criminal penalties for people that sell to the youth, and I guess that would be the jurisdiction of the Judicial Committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We talk a lot about tax reform as well, and I think all these things, we nibble around at the edges of these things, and we've done it for decades, and that's hence the $3.5 billion tax expenditure report. And I think we all look forward to the day when we can do a comprehensive review and start cleaning it up and coming at it instead of a piecemeal manner, straightforward. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Hoffman's statement that she just made was fascinating and actually flies in the face of all the evidence that we have. We know that children are extremely price sensitive to the cost of tobacco. We know they manage to get tobacco products in all kinds of different ways. And we also know that we do a lot of things in the tax bill trying to influence other kinds of policies. You yourself have given speeches this morning about our goals for this tax bill. It's not just confined to taxes. It's about generating jobs and all kinds of other economic activities. And the fact that kids have been smoking for years and years does not mean we can't do anything about it, because we've proven with tax policy that we can do a lot about tobacco use among youth through exactly that, tax policy.
say I'm happy to know that the tobacco company has such able defenders on this committee.
Well, and frankly, members, I see I see both sides of the argument and respect both sides.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, you know, we heard testimony today, and I think Ms. I'm not going to pronounce her name right, Molly, testified, you know, in support of our action, and now we're changing that direction, and I guess we're not going to hear the testimony on that. I mean, I think maybe the testimony would have been crafted a little different way on it. And so I don't know if they're going to get a chance to make another comment or not, but I just wanted to point that out, is that, you know, the testifiers before us didn't see this amendment prior to their testimony or knew that direction. So,
and Senator Howe, I don't think that their effort is going to end today. Mm-hmm. And I think that they'll be back. And, you know, as I said, it's a very subjective question on these issues, and minds and hearts are changing on those issues every day. So I believe that they will be back, and I hope they will be back. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as the author of the bill last year, and I know Senator Dibble apparently worked on it also, it was never intended and never brought forth as a revenue generator. It was always intended to be as a prevention measure, because children are, and these are children that are buying these products, are price sensitive and are influenced by colors and flavors and going forward, and they still think it's cool. So every movement I've made, whether it's a no smoking ban or the health impact fee, has always been towards prevention. I want that on the record. It's never been to generate revenue.
Thank you, Senator Rosen.
It should have a significant impact on these children if we'd pass that.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. Madam Mayor, we're back to Apple Valley's business. Let's talk about your TIF proposal.
Thank you, Madam Chair Ortman and members. Thank you for giving us your valuable time today. We've been before you with our pole in the ground, and we appreciate your consideration for Apple Valley's concerns in Senate File 1972. We need some latitude in Apple Valley, and we see that that fully developed at this project will be a mixed business campus. It will be 3 million square feet worth of commercial and office space and 2,000 housing units, and at fully projected 10,000 jobs that we will have in Apple Valley as a result of this TIF district. We thank you for your technical corrections to the bill, and if you have any questions, we're happy to answer those questions.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. All right, members, we are going to have Mr. Sylvia go over with us the mining reclamation policy that is included in this bill, so everyone can understand what we're trying to accomplish here. We're trying to set overall policy, Madam Mayor, to encourage not just Apple Valley but other communities similarly situated to take advantage of TIF for purposes of rehabilitating similar properties. I think it's good for the entire state, the proposal that you brought, and that's why I thought we should look at it further. And Mr. Casserly and Ms. Hani have been helping us craft a bigger policy. And so, Mr. Sylvia, if you would just lay out for everyone what that policy looks like now, and then we're going to take up the A15 amendment to accomplish Apple Valley's specific needs.
All
so,
right,
Mr.
Thank
Sylvia.
You, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. What the policy is that we created kind of this global soil deficiency district and then mining reclamation project area, and this was a combination of Senator Limmer's and Senator Gerlach's bill. What the changes relate to is that it kind of lowers the threshold as the bill exists now so that it would incorporate Apple Valley's specific needs relating to some parcel coverage. And as it stands now, the threshold would be perhaps a little too high for Apple Valley to meet. And then it also makes a change for some of the expenditures that the increment could be used to cover some of Apple Valley's specific needs.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvia. And so, Senator Michelle, would you offer the A15 amendment to accommodate the city of Apple Valley?
So moved.
Has that been handed out? Yes. All right. We have before us the A15. Mr. Sylvia, can you speak to how this would affect Apple Valley?
Yes, Madam Chair. On lines, page 62, line 12, as the bill stands right now, a soil deficiency district would be one in which authority finds by resolution that unusual terrain or soil deficiencies occur over 80% of the acreage. And what the changes relate to, it changes the threshold and requires that parcels consisting of 70% of the district contain unusual terrain or soil deficiencies that require substantial filling, grading, or other preparation. And for purposes of a parcel to be included, at least 50% of the area of that particular parcel would require substantial filling, grading, or other physical preparation for use. So it would lower the threshold to include particular parcels relative to Apple Valley. On page 62, lines 26 and 29, what this does is remove references to the requirement that commercial buildings in particular, the difficulty that commercial buildings may have for their construction given the terrain of the soil. The corrections would be to take out both references to commercial so that the lines would read peat or other soil with geotechnical deficiencies that impair development of buildings or infrastructure, so it would take out the requirement that those be commercial. And lastly, on page 63, again, it lowers the threshold for purposes of inclusion in the mining reclamation project area parcels characterized by the relevant condition. The change from 70% went down to 50% inclusion. And on page 63, line 24, to make this work for Apple Valley, we added one additional subdivision for which increment may be used for, and it would be up to 25% of the increment may be used for purposes under the redevelopment subdivision of the TIF law.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvia. And Madam Mayor and Mr. Casserly, the A15 amendment, your comments on that?
First of all, we appreciate that you've heard our request, and we concur.
Mr. Casserly?
Madam Chair and members, what we tried to do is emulate provisions of the redevelopment portions of the TIF Act. 20-some years ago, this would have been part of the redevelopment district provisions. So we've tried to emulate that to allow us to proceed.
Thank you. And Ms. Haney, are you comfortable with what we've done for the overall policy changes here? Senator Rest?
Madam Chair, I was just going to ask if to make sure that we understood this is not specific to Apple Valley. This is a general law provision, so it's not a special thing for Apple Valley.
Mr. Selby,
I mean,
it has
may
general
them,
application.
That's correct.
It's general application,
we should be
careful about that. That's all.
Yeah. Well, and Senator Rest, we try and learn from what's happening in some of these communities, and if it's good for one, it should be good for many, and all of them. And I think that's the approach we've taken with this.
Madam Chair, I'm just suggesting that we should be careful about making extremely lenient rules to apply generally when we're dealing with the TIF law. That's all.
Agreed.
I don't oppose it. I'm just saying we need to be cautious.
Agreed. Senator Howell?
Well, I was going along the same line as Senator Rest, Madam Chair, is that, you know, I'm concerned about lowering this, and you know, I think there's another way that I think communities, especially in mining areas, especially with some of the new mining that's going to occur, that we should be addressing. And I haven't heard, you know, I mean, there's, you know, Senator Bach is well aware of this in his area, where we should be having something at the local level or for reclamation purposes when these materials are being mined out for the reclamation process, rather than using a TIF district. And so I haven't heard testimony other than specifically to make this project work of why this is a good idea. And I guess I'd like to hear some broad general of why this application across our state would make sense, rather than just to make this change for that specific project to work, and then a little bit further discussion about, you know, what is your community proposing to make sure that we don't have to use TIF dollars and TIF dollars or TIF districts in the future, because there's going to continue to be in a mining operation in that area or down in that community, and we should be planning ahead for what happens when it's time to reclaim that land.
Senator Howe, there are communities that have aggregate taxes. In fact, the city of Vergas is going to be back next week to ask to do that. And so we all these different communities are in different stages. Some of these mine projects are already abandoned, and it's too late to charge any kind of a tax to put together a reclamation development fund. And so we're learning as we go here. Some have a tax with that, and some don't. And Apple Valley's in the situation where they've not done any reclamation fund, and so we're offering TIF or providing that as a after-the-fact kind of encouragement to redevelop these parcels. I think it's in everyone's best interest to give them a solution. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, and I'm not arguing that we shouldn't. I'm just arguing that we're making this change statewide. This is a general change, and I want to make sure that that's the right direction, not just that we're doing it for a specific project to fall into it. And I certainly would work with Senator Bach or whoever on trying to establish it, but it's never too late to start going down that road that we start planning ahead. I understand that we've got areas that are no longer deriving revenues from their aggregate or their mining operations, but we need to start somewhere on it. And so that's I just wanted to make that comment.
Well, and Senator Howe, I agree with you, but I think you should introduce a bill and let's work on that as a continuation of the direction that we're working on now. Senator Rust.
Madam Chair, Mr. Casserly mentioned that these changes are to reflect the percentages and the descriptions of that are in the redevelopment districts.
Excuse me, Senator Rust.
Statute.
If folks have their cell phones off, yeah. Would you please? Or cell phones on, please turn them off or take them off the table if you wouldn't mind. And Senator Rust, if you could speak just a little louder.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Casserly mentioned that some of these changes are proposed to reflect the limits and the restraints and so forth in the redevelopment statute. And I just wonder if going forward it might have been cleaner to describe this soil deficiency district as a type of redevelopment district and do everything by reference. It might be cleaner after you specify what it takes to be that kind of sub-district, and council might want to be looking at that going forward to see if that's a better way of dealing with this particular area. I don't have any language, but if that's one of the things that's accomplished by this amendment, that might be later on, that might be a way of bringing that into more regular TIF statutes by making it a type of redevelopment 25-year district.
Well, and I do think that's what we're intending here. And so, Mr. Casserly,
I wouldn't think
comment
you'd need
on
all the
that,
language,
or Mr.
Madam
Sylvia,
Chair.
Mr. Casserly.
Madam Chair, just in brief, when the Tax Increment Act was originally adopted, this language was essentially in there. And it was taken out about 15 years ago to create a different type of district, a soils condition district. So that's why people come back currently and ask for special law, because we would be going full circle. And there is nothing wrong with that. And I'd be happy to work with anybody on how those provisions could be included. But it could be a subset of a redevelopment district.
Just making an observation.
Ms. Haney, do you have any comments about that?
Kathy Haney, representing Maple Grove. Mr. Casserly has substantial more experience and expertise than I do in this area, but it does strike me, and we would certainly be happy to work with Senator Rest and you and anybody else to put it back in the redevelopment structure. However, there are some unique problems or challenges in developing these districts in the sense of staging, timing, et cetera. What at least Maple Grove is contemplating is not necessarily providing tax increment for any, and in their case, industrial manufacturing type business that would locate there, but viewing it on a case by case basis. And so what the structure, the way it's structured, and I think the current global language and our specific request allowed would be for districts to be set up over kind of a continuum, a time frame, and that's why there is a fair amount of time in there. The 5-year knockdown rule, for example, was extended to 10 years. And that's really why that was done, is to give the location the flexibility in developing this challenging area. So in some ways, I think as we go down a road of a redevelopment district, some of that would be a little confining, I think, in terms of, and in addition, the spending, again, because of the challenges of a gravel pit, the spending is allowed both within the district and within the project area, which is, of course, larger than the district. So, again, I think we would just have to be aware of those kinds of challenges as those areas are developed, and I'm sure we could work through all that.
Thank you, Ms. Haney. And Senator Rest, no, we're going to have a little time next week, and hopefully you and I can sit down with council, and maybe we can invite Ms. Haney and Mr. Casserly to help us sort through this, and maybe together we can come up with a proposal that may even add some additional benefit to the language we've got now. So I would invite you to do that with me and the others,
Madam,
as well.
Madam Chair, could I be Senator included Limmer in that, too?
Well, I don't know. No. Senator Limmer, of course. We would love to have you.
Thank you. Oh, thank you.
We have the A15 amendment before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. The A15 is adopted. Madam Mayor,
Madam Chair, and
Madam Casserly, Ms. Haney, thank you for your work on this, and Mr. Sylvia as well. Thank you.
Madam Chair, are you taking other amendments now?
I am, Senator Rest.
Well, then, Madam Chair, I have another TIF amendment that I'd like to offer.
Senator Rest, while you do that, would it be all right if we had Ms. McQuay? They're going to hand out the spreadsheet, and she can give us a quick update on the spreadsheet and where we're at before we take any more amendments.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I misplaced a...
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I... Council knows what... A14 amendment.
Senator Rest, could you pull that microphone a little directed toward
you?
Thank you.
The A14 amendment. I'd like to offer the A14 amendment. This deals with Brooklyn Park tax increment financing district. We had testimony on it. People from Brooklyn Park, I believe, are here.
Members, the A14 amendment is being handed out.
And. We look at the language that Senator Eaton had brought with us. We worked with, council, and what was determined to be a tighter language was to take all the special stuff out and just make a statement with regard to the 5-year rule, so to allow them until July 1st of 2014 a couple of extra years for the activities. This was the rehabbing of the hotel property at 694 and 81, and the chair had also asked for a not just a letter, but a resolution from the Brooklyn Park City Council. We have been provided that now, and I think the amendment belongs in this project now belongs in the and the bill, it's been fixed, as we say.
Senator Rest, is there an estimate of how many jobs might be created by the advantage of a TIF district
at
here?
The at their testimony on March 19th, or whenever the bill was held, we had a memorandum from the city of Brooklyn Park, and their positions were 20 in management. The hotel right now is closed; it's empty. At an annual wage range of $30,000 to $80,000, skilled hourly employees 26 positions, semi-skilled hourly 21 positions, and marginally skilled hourly 27 positions for a total of 94 at the Aquaplex. Facility. They had six positions, or their estimate is six positions, again with an annual wage range from $40,000 to $85,000, skilled hourly 13 total FTE positions, and semi-skilled hourly 11 total FTE positions for a total of 30. So that would bring you to 124 positions, ranging if you went to the just starting with the marginally skilled hourly at 20,000, 20,008, up to the management positions at a total top range of 85,000. So I think it does make a case for the positions or for the provision, and we and the more elegant way of approaching what they needed to do here was to grant an extension of the five-year rule, and much more straightforward.
Sir Rest, I'm familiar with this property. I drive by it every day I come here, and it kind of is it's kind of at a central intersection in between Brooklyn Park, Maple Grove, and Newhall, and an area that certainly is in need of some revitalization. It had a rather aggressive hospital, or not hospital, hotel center there, and for various business reasons, it just couldn't make it. And yet at the same time, it's got some raw material there that would really lend itself to this particular new purpose. I would think that this would be a very good recommendation to the tax committee.
So, Mr. Chairman, then I would move.
Is there further discussion?
The A14 amendment.
Hearing none, Senator Rest renews her motion on the A14 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman?
Any other amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I have the A12 amendment.
Pardon me, Senator Rest. Ms. McQuaid?
Madam Chair and members, or Mr. Chair, excuse me, and Mayor members, I can go through the revised spreadsheet now, and I think it'll be a lot easier to follow. the top of the page just notes that it's revised, and the timestamp at the bottom is 9:46. The first change was the one that I had mentioned that revenue had corrected for me. It was the marriage penalty conformity, and there was no change to this provision, but I had had reduction of 62.4, and it's a that was an old number, and it's only a reduction of 62.2, which that alone would put $200,000 on the bottom line. But the A21 amendment, the first change would be on line 9. The angel tax credit was $5 million, and this has changed to a $2 million reduction. Going from a cap of 12 to a cap of 14. The second change on the A2 amendment, following along with the spreadsheet, is on line 18. The statewide property tax levy phase out was a reduction in the first biennium of $31 million, and now the reduction is $29 million. I would just also note on that the tails on that might have to adjust slightly. And I can just note the bottom line on the tails there.
The next change is the data centers, and that's on line 26. And that was not found on the original spreadsheet because it was an addition of language to this bill. That change, Madam Chair, is found in the tails, and it's a $2.1 million reduction and a $6.4 million reduction in the tails based on a revenue estimate that we have for a previous bill. On line 27 is the Chamberlain Motor Vehicle Paint and Supplies Tax. That was an addition of $2.5 million, and that's zeroed out on the spreadsheet. The next on lines 28 through 33, that is the Senator Rosenbaum with the Little Cigars Tax. That netted out to a positive $2.6 million. And that then leaves the general fund tax revenue changes at $102.495 million.
Ms. McQuay, I may ask you to look at spreadsheet page 3 because we've got those non-general fund revenues that were impacted by those two bills. We may need to change. We don't need to do that right now, but we will need to make that change too when you have time.
Madam Chair, thanks. For that, I will make those corrections when the bill passes out of committee, and I have a little more time. Madam Chair and members, I would also like to note on the line 78 on page 2, the bottom line to the general fund, and I've just wrote in the changes so that you can follow along with the lines there, is $134,000 positive to the general fund, keeping the transfer from the budget reserve at what it is in the bill.
Thank you, Ms. McQuay. Questions or comments about this new revised spreadsheet? Senator Scoy.
Yeah, well, briefly, Madam Chair, the number that you know, on the bottom far left on page 1, we've increased our deficit spending by another three-some million dollars by this amendment.
Senator Scoy, the draw on the reserve, if we can't find the state budget reductions, is still the same.
Well, Madam Chair, this is Senator not Scoy. Talking about what's on page 2, the draw on the reserves. This is the out of balance in the tails for 14 and 15. It was $187 million, and now it's $191.
Yep.
So for the 14-15 biennium, we're increased the deficit spending by over $3 million.
Senator Scoy, that's factual. Other questions or comments about the spreadsheet? Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I'm not sure maybe I missed it, but the provision that was removed
supplies, maybe you said something. Do the tails still hold, or do those go away?
Ms. McQuay.
Madam Chair, Member and Senator DeBell, the on line 27, the motor vehicle paint and supplies, the tails are zeroed out. If you're looking at the line 82 on page 3, the chair had noted to me that we need to remove those lines as well, and so those would zero out on page 3 because I only tracked the general fund and I didn't carry over my changes to the non-general fund revenue, so my apologies to the committee for the confusion.
And Senator Dibble, the tails that you're talking about are referring to the data centers and not to the motor vehicle. Yeah, it happens. Other questions or comments about the spreadsheet? All right, then. Senator Rest, you said you had another amendment?
I had another amendment, the A-12 amendment, Madam Chair.
The members were doing well on time. I'm still hoping we might be done by 11 o'clock today, so if you're ready with your amendments, we'll proceed, and hopefully members will keep their seats and will vote as necessary and hopefully move this bill out. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, the A-12 amendment, refers to an exemption for mobile medical vehicle purchases that we heard. I think it was brought by Senator Sharon. The total impact retroactively is $30,000, $18,000 in the high Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and this is from revenue, and then the Transit Assistance Fund of $12,000. Just to refresh your memory about the proposal, mobile medical vehicles are subject to the motor vehicle sales tax, and the proposal is to exempt from invest the purchase of a motor vehicle that's used exclusively as a mobile medical unit for the provision of medical or dental services by a federally qualified health center that was part of the federal omnibus budget reconciliation act some 20 years ago. Right now, there are currently 18 federally qualified health centers with approximately 45 locations that are licensed by the Department of Health, and three of the 18 centers, just three, have mobile medical or dental vehicles, and each has two vehicles for a total of six current vehicles. One of the 18 centers purchased two mobile medical vehicles since December 31st, 2010, and the sales tax on those two vehicles was $30,000. It's not expected, it's a one-time cost. It's not expected that any of the other health centers will purchase qualifying mobile medical vehicles during the forecast period. It assumes that the refunds for the vehicles would qualify those two would be paid in fiscal year 2013. I think these mobile medical units are used in Greater Minnesota, and the bill was brought to us by Senator Sharon, and affects the area around Mankato, and it might affect Senator Rosen's. Area as well, if she would like to speak in support of the amendment.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator S., for bringing this up. This is a very critical, especially out in Greater Minnesota, where our dental, especially with the dental issue, because many dentists are not accepting any more MA patients, and so this is extremely important. We have one facility or one health center in Mankato called the Open Door, and the CEO, Sarah Cruz, is here if there's any questions and if she could come up and testify. But it is really important to be able to have this new ability to get out amongst this area, that's Greater Minnesota, where we just don't have the facilities anymore and people are not covering these. There's not the providers out there.
Well, Senator Rosen, Senator Rest, I think this is a good proposal. I'm a little puzzled about the fiscal impact because I think it goes to non-general fund sources of revenues. I think they're transportation funds, and I'm going to ask Ms. McQuay to advise the committee on that.
Madam Chair and members, we did get a revenue note on this amendment, as this was also the amendment that is bringing the transportation bill to this committee. The bill reduces the highway user tax distribution fund by $18,000 and the Transit Assistance Fund by $12,000 for a total all funds reduction of $30,000. And that is all non-general fund money.
Okay. Members, as I said, I'm supportive. We also have the transportation bill coming up next week. We could actually put it in two places. I'm not opposed to that. And so I'm seeing some nods. Senator Rest has offered the A-12. Questions, comments, or are there folks that would like to testify one way or the other?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm a lobbyist representing the Federally Qualified Healthcare Centers, MNAC, here in Minnesota, and Sarah Cruz is with me. We do support the legislation. We don't want to take the committee's time if not necessary, but we are very supportive of this, and Open Door has a great need for the passage of this amendment. Putting it in two places would be even better. We'd love to suggest three places, and we'll try to find a third.
Mr. Griffin, I think you're going to get your amendment passed here, so I think read the tea leaves here, and I think if you let us vote, I think you're gonna see it in this bill. When the car is sold, my father used to say, you stop talking. So With that, Senator Rust moves the A-12 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. The A-12 is adopted. Congratulations, Mr. Griffin. Other amendments for Senate File 1972. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A-8 amendment.
A-8 amendment, Senator Skoy. Do you want to discuss what the A-8 amendment accomplishes while it's being passed out?
The A-8 amendment is an amendment brought to me by Senator Langseth. It's a tax exemption for flood damage, for new residential construction in flood damaged cities. Currently, we have a provision in law that gives this exemption that is paid by state dollars. That's six. That's expiring. This new provision would give the same exemption, but would have the local property tax jurisdictions pick up the cost within their jurisdiction. The department has done a fiscal analysis based on the current program. It does result in a very small savings to the general fund in 2015. But the primary purpose of this is to help those western cities that have had flood damage compete with North Dakota, who offers a comparable property tax exemption for their new home construction.
Senator Skoy, I wish you'd have brought this to our attention a little earlier. You said there was a bill that was introduced?
Madam Chair, this was brought to me by Senator Langseth to offer his amendment. I don't know if he has a bill or not.
And there is a fiscal impact, I understand,
Madam Chair, but it's a positive fiscal impact. It's
Ms. McQuay, do you have a fiscal note or a revenue note?
Madam Chair and members, the revenue note shows that there's some shift in the and exemptions in the property tax refunds, and that nets out to a positive $15,000 in fiscal year 15.
Ms. McQuay, can we have the fiscal or the revenue note passed out, copied and passed out? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Skoy, is this strictly for the area of Senator Langseth's flooded area? Because there is quite a few areas in southern Minnesota. Senator Sinjum has a whole community that was wiped out. I received significant damage in the 2010 floods. Truman all the way through St. Clair took out homes. And so to me, it looks like this is directed towards just that area of Senator Langseth's area.
Senator Skoy.
Well, Madam Chair, I think according to the language, they have to have this FEMA designation. I don't know if these communities down in southern Minnesota have received that designation or not. The communities that are listed in the qualifying cities that are listed by the department that qualified for the previous program were Moorhead, Dilworth, East Grand Forks, and Breckenridge.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, I would be interested in finding out if I know they received in my community, in my district, they did receive FEMA dollars and they had FEMA involvement and they were there. They were parked there for months. So I'm not sure if these designations would apply or if this is specific, but it's something I would like to look into if that was.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Rosen, well, you know, if we adopt the A8 amendment, would certainly encourage you to check with your communities to see if they did get this designation or not. But we've done this in the past where these communities that have this flood damage, somebody coming into those communities and doing new residential construction has received this property tax break. Only in the past, the state has picked up the cost. Now, we recognize that the state isn't going to do that this time around because we don't have the dollars for it. But if the communities want to do this internally within their own property tax levy, it seems reasonable. But I would check and see if your communities received this. I mean, I'm not familiar with what a FEMA DR-1830 is, but somebody would
Senator
know that.
Senator Skoy, that's a disaster recovery area. I mean, it's a designated area. Mm-hmm. Senator Skoy, I'm going to ask you to consider laying this bill on the table. And we are going to take up next week policy and technical bills that have no fiscal impact in this biennium. This one has a slight impact, I think, but I haven't read the revenue note. In the next biennium, it might be appropriate for next week. But I think it needs a little bit more consideration, and I know Senator Rosen's question is a good one. I know you'd like to answer that question, so I would ask you to consider laying this bill on the table for further consideration and work.
Sure, Madam Chair, if the small positive fiscal impact isn't going to be an issue for the policy bill, I would be happy to have it go in the policy bill.
Madam Chair?
Okay, Senator Skoy, the correct motion I'm advised is not to lay it on the table, but to withdraw the amendment when you're ready to do that. Senator Rust.
Madam Chair, I'd be interested to know the references in line 1-8 and 1-9 to the statutes 469-1731, are those cities described or are they named in that? Can council tell us where
Senator Rust, before we do too much of that, I'm hoping that we're going to save this conversation for next week. And if there hasn't been a bill introduced,
I need that kind of information.
I would appreciate that. And then we'll make time for it next week, Senator Skoy, if you're willing.
And as long as you're willing to consider it in your bill with that small fiscal.
Senator Skoy, I think it's beyond the scope of this bill for this conversation today. And I have every reason to believe we can take this up next week. And if it has a positive fiscal impact, slightly in the out years, I don't see that it breaks any of the internal rules we have about that policy and technical bill for next week.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll withdraw the A8 amendment.
Thank you, Senator Skoy. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A3 amendment. And while that's being passed out, if I could explain that. It's an amendment that was brought to me by Senator Nelson, and actually we had a conversation in this committee with the Angel Investment.
Thank you.
tax credit to mending it. Actually, this bill, Senator Nelson's, passed through the Jobs Committee, and it's a 40% credit for Greater Minnesota. And we actually, I think it was Mr. Nelson from Deed was up there, and I asked that specific question about the disbursement of the dollars and the number of companies that are receiving the investments. And I do have another handout here too, Madam Chair, that can show what the number of businesses in 2010 received the qualifying investment, and then the number of total investments in 2010. So I do have a handout here if we could pass that out also. So basically it passed out of the committee with a bipartisan vote. Up to 40%. There's also language in here amended by Senator Torres Ray to track the number of businesses that are minority or women owned, and it would just apply to Greater Minnesota businesses. When you look at the diagram, you'll see that it's quite stark, the number of dollars versus in Greater Minnesota versus the number of dollars in the metro area, but more telling is the number of businesses in Greater Minnesota that received funds versus the metro area. And really, it's kind of unfair to look at the total investment, the number of dollars, $12 million, because that could be two or three companies that could suck that all up or make use of all those dollars. So we're trying to get at more businesses and expanding more opportunities out in Greater Minnesota.
Senator Michelle?
Madam Chair and members, I wonder if Mr. Nelson from who runs this, director of the Angel Program, could share with us a few minutes of his time. We did have a discussion of this in the Jobs Committee, and it Senator Rosen, I think it's fair to say there was bipartisan support and bipartisan discomfort. I think that's a fair way to put it. And so what I thought would be helpful for members at this point is I know the geographic reach of the Angel Tax Program has been something that Mr. Nelson has been spending a lot of time and attention on, and he can talk a little bit to that. And then I guess I'd share my general thought on this is it's a little early. The program hasn't been in existence for more than 2 years. We're just kind of starting to develop a track record. I think we do need to be sensitive to the reach of the program, but Mr. Nelson, if you could just touch on that, and some of this we covered in both the Jobs Committee and maybe even some of your testimony before this group before.
Madam Nelson, Chair. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, Senator Rosen. I'm Jeff Nelson. I'm the Angel Tax Coordinator for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. As Senator Rosen pointed out, we have had in our 2010 annual report to the legislature, we did express our concern with the lack of investment in Greater Minnesota. We revised some of the numbers based on new information. In 2010, five businesses in Greater Minnesota received investment pursuant to the program. That did increase to 13 businesses in 2011. And as Senator Rosen pointed out, the amount of investment did increase very substantially. It went from $1.7 million to over $12 million in Greater Minnesota pursuant to the program. I would like to personally take a little bit of credit for that. We recognized that this was a problem in 2010. In 2011, we began an outreach program. We spent time in more than a dozen communities in Greater Minnesota educating businesses, investors, economic developers about the program. We plan to continue that in 2012 and hope to see success in more investment occurring in Greater Minnesota.
Mr. Nelson. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple questions. I actually am from Greater Minnesota, but I'm wondering if we have a definition of what is Greater Minnesota. Is it a geographic area? Is it a distance from the metro? And then the second part of that question is how many people reside in what we call Greater Minnesota? Is it comparable to what's in the metro? I guess I'm not clear what we're actually calling Greater Minnesota, knowing that I live in Greater Minnesota.
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, we define the metro area as the seven county metropolitan area. I don't think I'm an expert on population figures, though I think it's 2.5-3 million of the state's population lives in the metro area, and the remainder about 5 million, total 5 million being in all of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the
Senator
definition
Rest.
Is on page 4. Lines 4.4 that he just pointed out. So it's
Senator
pretty
Michelle.
Bright line.
Senator Michelle.
And so, Madam Chair, maybe just a little more from Mr. Nelson, but my instinct on this is that it's not necessary to prescribe these kind of numbers into the law just yet. It's unnecessary, and it's premature because we're still building a track record. But Mr. Nelson, remind me, you have had what I'm going to refer to as road shows, but I'm saying it wrong, and you've coordinated with this Angel Network, which is trying to spread the word across the state. Could you give us a little more of how you're getting the word out?
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, yes. Part of the dozen or more road shows that we conducted in 2011, we are working together with the Minnesota Angel Network as well as other organizations. The Minnesota Angel Network is a new nonprofit organization. What it's doing is working with businesses and investors to educate them about the program. Primarily what it's doing is it's working with the new high-tech emerging businesses to get them in a position such that they are able to communicate with investors effectively and efficiently. Investors do not want to be meeting with companies that aren't prepared, don't have their business plans, don't have their financials in order, don't have their due diligence prepared to hand out. So the Minnesota Angel Network, and I am part of that network and indeed is working with that organization, is working with the Angel Network to set up four business intake centers in Greater Minnesota so that businesses throughout the state can take better advantage of the Angel Tax Credit Program. They're just starting this program this year. Those intake centers are just being set up. They're working in combination with the Small Business Development Centers, and we're hoping to see in 2012 a much greater impact on this combined effort.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate that, Mr. Nelson. And I think also in your comments the other day, too, is that you were looking for ideas and of how to get the information out. And I personally don't think there's anything wrong with an incentive to get this information out to Greater Minnesota. And that's basically what this is an incentive and a push. And when we really started looking at the bioscience or high-tech industry, we looked at the entire state as a whole. because it includes not only the medical devices, but manufacturing and also agriculture. And so this is a way to make sure that we continue to look at the state as a whole and not just concentrate on the seven-county metro area. But, Madam Chair, I do have an alternative that was actually the House language, but I would like to see where everybody sits with this 40% credit for Greater Minnesota.
Other comments or questions about the A15 amendment?
A3,
excuse me. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have a different question about the A3, and it goes to the question I had yesterday when Senator Michelle wasn't here. And that was the piece that took out the definition of intern and then took out on page 1, you can see it under paragraph H, and then took out the requirement that businesses pay employees wages of 175% of the federal poverty guidelines and interns 175% of the federal minimum wage, which this amendment would restore. Senator Michelle, I was wondering why we were doing that in the first place, and if the restoration of that in the Rosen amendment was going to be a significant problem, given that there seemed to be an effort to change that for some reason in your bill.
Thank you, Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dibble. I'm just seeing the Rosen amendment. So, is it your thought that you like the Rosen amendment because of the language on interns and kind of the prevailing wage discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Yeah, I like that aspect of the Rosen amendment. Yes, I would like to restore that language. Yes, the Rosen amendment accomplishes that.
Madam Chair or Council. Where in the A3, or let's put it this way, where does the A3 change the language in the underlying bill on that issue?
Well, Madam Chair, the A3 is a delete section 1 and insert. It replaces the entire section with this language.
Senator Michelle, are you thinking that you might divide the amendment?
I was not thinking that, Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
I'm sorry, Senator Dibble, if I missed part of the discussion at another committee, but in general, what we've discovered on the intern issue is that because there was this minimum that these new startups just weren't hiring interns. Well, that's not a good result. We want them hired. The second issue has received more attention and discussion, certainly in the Jobs Committee it did too. And I think that gets to the debate we've had in this committee and in other committees and, frankly, even on the floor about how much do you want state law to mandate on the prevailing wage, minimum wage, family wage issue. And my personal belief is that the angel tax program is not the place for that debate. But I know others have strong feelings. What we want the angel tax program to accomplish is to grow small businesses, particular kinds of small businesses, at a very fragile stage when they need that seed money, and to kind of broaden it into the living wage discussion. I think it's just misplaced, and so that is what language that we passed out of the Jobs Committee reflected, and I'm trying to catch up on this now.
Yeah. Madam
Senator
Chair,
Dibble.
I can probably predict my response, which is what is the point of expending public dollars to grow jobs if they're not even halfway decent jobs? I think the minimum expectation of 175% of poverty, that's not a lot of money. That's not even a very good job.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
And Senator Dibble. I think there are many fathers and mothers of the Angel Tax Credit Program. It's been bipartisan in multiple administrations now, and now Mr. Nelson's living and breathing it every day. I think the bipartisan beginnings of this was to grow companies, not jobs. I think that's an important distinction, and I appreciate how you value jobs and believe there should be a certain amount of wages tied to that, but you don't get the jobs until you first get the companies. And that is, and you seed those companies again at the right time. That's what the Angel Tax Credit, I believe, is. That's the promise of it, and that's the initial results that we're getting.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I think if the public were to check in on an expenditure of dollars like this, and it meant that we were simply spawning poverty wage jobs, we would be judged pretty harshly for expending tax dollars for jobs that were paying poverty level wages. That's not something I want to be a party to, or a policy or a program that I want to support.
Senator Michelle?
Madam Chair, I don't know if Mr. Nelson has an example or two of the kind of companies that are starting to grow that have benefited from this, and then the kind of jobs that are attached to it. That might be helpful to at this discussion right now, Mr. Nelson. But again, this is in its infancy.
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, Senator Dibble, I am probably one of the mothers and fathers of this program also. I do recall that in past discussions before both the Jobs Committee and the Tax Committee, I believe that one of the reasons the Angel Tax Credit Program was restricted to primarily high-tech businesses was that it was discovered that high-tech businesses are a industry that does pay good wages. And because of that, it was decided to restrict program to those types of businesses in the effort to gain more high-paying jobs. And as a result of that, that provision was originally included in the legislation. I am seeing that about half of the companies, or somewhat less than half of the companies that do participate in the program, actually have no employees. Those companies that do have employees, of course, all do meet the requirements of the program in that they do pay all their employees more than the 175% of a poverty level for a family of four. As I pointed out to both the Jobs and Taxes Committees in previous testimony, all $16 million in credits that we awarded last year did go to the businesses that could meet the requirements of the program, and we were oversubscribed. We did run out of money in mid-November.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. A quick question for you. I believe the A3 amendment may have been drafted more broadly than you intended, and I'm going to ask either Ms. Pollack or Ms. McQuay to identify what we think is the concern, and you can maybe advise as to whether you want to make some changes to the amendment. Ms. McQuay?
Madam Chair and members, just to make the A3 amendment to what Senator Rosen would like it to reflect, if you just look at the A3 amendment, what it would do is on line 1.3, we'd delete the language that says delete section 1. So the language would read page 1, insert section 1. And on line 36, the language would then read page 2, insert, if we delete the language that says delete section 2 or delete the instructions.
Ms. McQuay, are you saying that we should delete the language on line 1.3 that says delete section 1?
And
then also on line 1.36, delete the language that says delete section 2.
And, Madam Chair, correct. And then on page 4, line 12, the same instruction would be to delete the instructions that say delete section 3 and what this would do is in the bill it would have the two sections together, but on the first engrossment, the two sections would be engrossed together. So it doesn't have the effect of removing any language that's currently in the bill, but rather it would just add the language that Senator Rosen has reflected in the A3 amendment to the existing delete everything amendment.
Senator Rosen?
I believe that's okay, Senator. I think
what you're saying is supplementing. They're saying the intention they thought was to supplement Senator Michelle's language and not to delete Senator Michelle's language. Was that your intention, Senator Rosen?
Yes.
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, my question is: the Rosen Amendment is an amendment to the delete all, so it's already an amendment to an amendment. So, is additional revisions to it allowed?
Deep.
Senator,
just
Bach,
incorporate the changes.
That's what we've been doing. I mean, yes.
But the Rosen Amendment is an amendment to the delete all. And I don't believe the rules allow us to make an amendment to an amendment. An amendment. A third amendment, I don't believe, is allowed.
Well, I'll ask counsel.
And so I think it's
advise.
As easy as just Senator Rosen, if you really want to do it, Senator Rosen just withdrawing hers and submitting something new. But I'm not sure you can offer three amendments.
We'll check.
The changes.
We'll check,
just
Senator
incorporate
Bach.
The changes,
so we can come back to that, to the any oral amendment, but we're still in the middle of the conversation about the merits of the amendment without that, Senator Rosen. So maybe we can continue on that. Are there other comments or questions about the merits of Senator Rosen's A3? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I actually just would really like my amendment on or Senator Nelson's. And if you just go back to the 2010 businesses to receive qualifying investment chart here on the left-hand side, and when you remember that 40% of the population of Minnesota resides in Greater Minnesota, I don't think we're asking for a whole lot here. And, we had high-tech industries do not have to just be in the 7-county metro area. We need to have strong livable wages out there, and we have to keep Greater Minnesota strong, and this is one way of doing it. And I just, again, think it's very important to have a set goal.
Thank you. Senator Michelle, and then Senator Hoffman. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Senator Rosen's point, I was just handed a note about the population in Minnesota. We've got a total of 5.3 million and some odd thousands. In the metro area, it's 2.8 million people, and in the Greater Minnesota, it's 2.4, and that actually works out to be 46% of Minnesota's population. So I actually think Senator Rosen's amendment is actually very reasonable, so I support it.
Senator Hoffman, that's good information on the fly. Other questions or comments? I don't think that we have the answer yet, Senator Rosen, so on whether we can amend the amendment.
Madam Chair, what are we amending? Just the poverty level, the
175%? I think there was an error in the drafting of the A3 amendment, that it went further than you intended. At least that's what I'm understanding, is that instead of supplementing Senator Michelle's angel tax credit language in the underlying bill, your amendment would delete his language and insert your amendment. And I don't think your intention was to delete his angel tax credit language, all of it.
No.
Was it?
No, that's right.
And so that's what we're debating right now, is whether or not we can amend your amendment. And Senator Bach, in his chairmanship days, didn't allow that and believes there's a rule that prevents it. So that's what we're trying to research. Senator Rust.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't agree. She can just say, I'm changing my amendment. And as long as it's not someone else amending it, if it's the author of the amendment says, I want to take something out, it's perfectly fine. It's if Senator Marty wanted to amend an amendment, but that's not what.
Right.
I mean, you know, Senator Marty, we wouldn't take anything there, but, you know, I think, yeah, so she can do it herself, just someone, she can change her amendment and be done with it.
Senator Rosen, would you like to make the changes that Ms. McQuay has outlined?
No, Madam Chair, I would not. I'd like to leave it as is.
All right, Senator Rosen. So we have before us the A3 amendment. Is there anyone else that would like to testify or have questions or comments about the A3 amendment? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, just a comment on the 40% level. I know these are highly risky investments, but the reason people make them is not because they're angels, but because there's a good payoff when they win. And the 25% investment credit is a huge credit already, and, I mean, 40% is a lot bigger. And I guess they're making the investments not solely because of the credit, but at a certain point, you know, we're basically making their investment for them. We're getting closer to that level. I think this is way too high.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Other questions or comments? Then Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair and members, I just want to say, and I think every one of us can probably think of an occasion with respect to somebody that we knew that either wanted to take a chance or did take a chance. I just think it's important, and particularly in rural Minnesota right now, when there are many challenges out there, to the extent we can put forth an opportunity for someone who, frankly, just would dare to dream and take a chance and invest everything he or she has into a business that might grow and prosper at some point to the benefit of our great state. I think this is a good bill, and I think we ought to give it a chance, and hopefully we can move it forward.
Sure. Senator Senjum. Senator Rosen moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
No. The ayes have it. The A3 is adopted. Other amendments.
Madam Chair.
Senator Chamberlain.
I have the A2.
Do you want to describe the A2, Senator Chamberlain?
I will. This is much easier. Sometime last week, this came along fairly late, but last week I was approached by people who provide day training and habilitation services for disabled people. They transport these individuals to and from places, and for years they had been taking a fuel tax credit refund at the end of the year for the fuel tax for the tax and the fuel that they consumed during the year. They've been submitting a refund and getting that money back. Well, what happened was some folks at the DOR found out that this was not technically correct, and they said you don't qualify because you're not defined as an exemption in the code and statute. So they were going to have to pay quite a substantial amount of money if the statute of limitations runs would have been back for years, but they had agreed to cut it back to probably 3 years. But this is a substantial amount of money for companies and services that get state and federal aid to provide service to disabled. So what we're trying to do is, they thought they fit into a medical transport exemption, but they don't. So what this amendment does is it creates a specific exemption for the day training and habilitation services provider, so that they can continue getting this exemption and this refund, and B, they don't have to then go back into their pockets, and which is taxpayer money to start with, and pay back the DOR. This is going to go to transportation as well. There is a fiscal note to it. I think it's about $2.5 million, but they've been getting the refund for this time. So the $2.5 million, yes, they by statute technically that's correct, but they've been getting the refund, so this really would have no impact to the general fund. They'd have to score it that way, but since they're already getting the refunds, they're going to continue to get the refunds if this goes through. It'd be a zero impact. So that's what this is, Madam Chair.
Well, Senator Chamberlain, this is I believe, more appropriate for the transportation bill that's going to be heard next week, and I would ask you to consider. I'm glad that you advised everybody about this amendment, but I would ask you to consider withdrawing it at this time and offering it next week when we hear the transportation bill.
I will do that, Madam Chair. I'll withdraw it.
On that, Senator Bach?
Madam Chair, Senator Chamberlain, what is the reason for the March 1st effective date rather than day following enactment or August 1st, which would have been the normal course of law? How do you the importance of March 1st. I mean, because that's retroactively.
Yeah, I'll get that clarified, Senator Bach. But my belief is that it's probably when they go to apply for a refund at some point, and they don't want to have to go back and pay an amount that they should be due. So they're trying to cover that stuff behind them as well. But maybe counsel could help out briefly. I could find out and bring it back to Senator Bach.
Senator Chamberlain, are you withdrawing the A2?
Yeah. Yes, I am.
Before you do that, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Chamberlain. Well, I hope we're able to accomplish this amendment. I have heard from my folks up north about this. It's important that we get this accomplished. You're absolutely right in that they used to receive this exemption, and because of a change at the department, they would no longer. I think the March 1st date is important is because they've been sent notices back to that date that they owe the money. I think that's why they're going retroactive, but we can verify that. I do have a little bit of concern about the $2.5 million and how the transportation bill is going to deal with that, because this is the tax committee and the one that would have the capabilities to deal with some of those issues. I'm a little nervous about that, but you know, if you're going to withdraw it, I'll support it when we're doing the transportation bill, but I would also be supportive of it today.
Madam Chair,
Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, we'll work on that fiscal note.
Thank Senator you. Chamberlain, I urge you to talk to Senator Gimsey about this, because he will be here when we take up any amendments to his bill. So,
Go on there.
Senator Chamberlain. So are you withdrawing the A2 at this time?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Chamberlain. Others with an amendment. Senator Dibble, did you have an amendment? Others with an amendment? Seeing none. Then are there others from in the room that would like to testify either for or against the bill as amended?
Madam Chair.
Senator Russ? No. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have an amendment. It was the A19 amendment. It was on the fair market value deduction for the contributions of food inventory that we had in our tax bill last year, and it was also in the House bill. It was, of course, vetoed by the governor, and then it never made it through the special session. I do realize there is a fiscal note to this, and but I just wanted to stand up and say that this deduction or subtraction for the charitable contributions of food inventory is really a very important issue, and I would hope that we could entertain it sometime, but there is, I think, a $300,000 fiscal note. So I just wanted to put that on the record, too, and Mr. Cirola is here if anybody wanted to hear that testimony.
Senator Rosen, it's a commendable idea.
I know.
Did it get anywhere in the House, Senator Rosen?
I don't think so, Madam Chair.
Well, this is one of those efforts that is not going to end until we've accomplished it, and I hope that's the case.
Madam Chair, it was the House Chair's initiative last year, too. So I just wanted to say that.
Senator Rosen, are you withdrawing the A19?
Yes, I am.
Other amendments. Then Senator Michelle would move Senate File 1972 as amended be recommended and passed to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say no.
No.
The chair is in doubt. all those in favor, please signify by raising your hand. For you to count.
Yeah. Whoever has the loudest voice.
All right, and all those opposed, same sign. Raise your hand.
You guys make a lot of noise.
There being 8 ayes and 4 nays. I'm sorry.
Died.
Members, please don't leave. I thought that we adopted the A1 amendment previously.
Did we?
We did. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Council is just confused. So, seeing that 1972 as amendment has been recommended to pass, we are now adjourned, and thank you all for your hard work in working on this bill.
When are we coming back?